Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to the Chills at Will podcast, episode 51. I am very lucky today to be joined by Marina Benzon. Benzon, like hey. your Mercedes-Benz is on, is the way she described it, right?
Exactly.
She is a poet, actor, and filmmaker, and she proudly hails from the Bay Area, where she received a bachelor's degree in broadcast electronic communication arts, with emphasis in screenwriting and video production, and a minor in theater performance from San Francisco State University. She became the 2013 recipient of the PNA in the Arts Scholarship, which enabled her to pursue performance arts and creative writing. Now published in several literary magazines such as Zana, Firefly Literary, and Goat's Milk Literary, Marina strives to produce honest and eclectic work that speaks to her personal narrative as a first-generation queer woman living in America. I know, of course, the male is Pinoy. Did I pronounce the female version correctly?
It's a Pinay.
Pinay. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And how
about
that?
It's kind of weird.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's like Pinay and Pinoy. So it's the first pin and then oi.
Okay.
I appreciate that. But that was pretty good. That wasn't bad.
And how about that literary magazine? Is it Zana? Zana?
Zana.
Zana. Okay.
Yeah, I believe so. They're great. I've got published by them twice and I just got a third from them. So their next issue has one of my newer poems.
That's awesome. It's kind of like one of those phenomena where like, you know, a word, some vocab word, some high level word, you know it, you can use it, but you've never heard it pronounced out loud.
Yeah.
But maybe that's, maybe that's what the magazine, right?
Yeah. You know, the word gregarious.
You said it right.
For a really long time, I'm like, great word. I know, but every time I read it, my initial thing is to be like gregarious. It's the worst.
Right. Well, thanks again for making the time, and it's a pleasure to have you. And, you know, although you are in LA right now, this is an all Northern California team, so we got to give props to that. So I'm in Sacramento, and
you're
of course in the Bay Area. So
we're gonna
say hella time.
As many times as I can say hella, I will find all the opportunities, I promise.
When I was a kid, I didn't know if hella was like a bad word, so I keep it clean. I'd say hecka, like, you know, it's hecka tight.
I used to do that too. My mom, weirdly enough, was like, you can't say hella. That's taking the, like, right. I don't know, romanticizing hell. And I'm like, it's a word. So I switched to hecka as well.
That's that Catholic school education for both of us, right?
Right.
I love to hear about growing up in the Bay Area, some of your influences, just in general, you know, what were you reading? And, you know, did you feel like you were reading books that had people like you? Did you see yourself in what you read, especially growing up?
When I was a kid, no, I never did.
So one word, no period.
Yeah. Easy answer. And it wasn't something I questioned as like a precocious 10-year-old, not at all. I mean, mind you, the things that I was reading, like my favorite books as a kid was Series of Unfortunate Events by Lemony Snicket, Captain Underpants, and a real panty dropper of a book is A Child's Called It.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
I know that those three were my favorite. I read those all the time. So it was a little strange as a kid, but not at all did I see myself or someone, a person of color, in any of the books I was reading.
Did you grow up speaking Tagalog and English? Did you only speak English, monolingual, bilingual? How did language work in your childhood?
So my parents spoke Tagalog because they're from the Philippines and Japan. And I picked up on it, but I wasn't able to speak because this is very normal for a lot of POC immigrant families, is they try to teach their kids to only speak English because they'll have more opportunities.
Okay.
And obviously my parents had a little bit more difficulty finding jobs and, you know, landing a place to live just because they had an accent. So they had to sort of beat it out of their own tongue. So they made sure with my sister and I to learn English and only speak English. But I do know a lot of Tagalog in terms of I can translate.
Okay.
And my parents could speak to me in Tagalog and I can answer back in English.
I appreciate that. And, you know, besides the Nobel Prize winning, you know, Captain Underpants, et cetera. As you got a little bit older in high school and even college, what were you reading and what did interest you, whether you did see yourself in that reading or not?
You know what? By the time I became a teenager, I stopped reading, actually. Mm. I was really concerned about being cool and was like, I'm into only music and films and all these things. And I started to not read as much. And my parents use reading as a disciplinary action. So okay. Like, if you're bad, you're grounded and you're going to have to read a book. So I started to taper off from reading around my teenage years. Mm-hmm. It was mainly like whatever, you know, my high school made me read at the time.
Were you like a budding film, like critic? Were you watching like, you know, these highbrow type of movies? Were you into like, I don't know, a certain genre? Like what was interesting to you in those times?
I really liked, in high school, I really loved like vignettes. Mm. One of my favorite movies is like Paris, I Love You.
Okay.
And it's a series of all different kinds of narratives and stories coming together and they're all sort of interwoven. So I loved films like that. My film teacher in high school actually recommended that movie to me. And then it started to evolve. I started to really love dark comedies and like absurd comedies. And I thought like, that is so weird and fun and unsettling and strange, but it also felt very honest.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a little older and I really started to love like mumblecore movies.
Tell me about that.
So it's a fusion of an improvised script and an outline. And Joe Swansburg, my favorite director, okay. He takes his time doing films like this. He did this with Drinking Buddies, was Happy Christmas. So he has the actors, he gives them an outline of what needs to be accomplished in this scene, but there are no lines. The actors have to be creative. They have to be on their feet. They have to embody their character. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I was like, I want film like that. I want a film like that so badly because it felt a little bit more true and honest. And I found myself really falling in love with it over and over again through whether that be through the medium of film or through music or through books.
Your folks down in LA might not agree, but obviously, but the Bay Area, the Bay Area has some of the greatest hip hop, you know, that's out there. Were you into hip-hop?
I am not gonna
or rock or what kind of, yeah.
Yeah, no, when I was a teenager, I loved hip hop and I am not going to fight you. As much as I am in LA, I will not say I'm like, I will not claim LA as my own. I will always tell people like I'm from the Bay Area.
All right.
Because I have so much love for the Bay because it is very different. Mm-hmm. It does feel like it's a different state than Los Angeles or SoCal rather.
Uh-huh.
But I was listening to Mac Dre, Talib Kweli, who's not really from the Bay, but it's right. Now recently, well, E-40 too, because E-40 dropped a huge bomb of a song that started the hyphy movement. Do you remember that?
Oh, that was like 2007, 2008, right? Sounds like right when you're about.
Yes, I was in high school. Yeah, I was like, everybody went stupid, dumb, and hyphy all the time.
Right. This was probably 3 or 4 years ago. So I'm too old to go to a concert. Right. And fortunately, the one I picked was Action Bronson and E-40, you know, E-40 is like 79 years old and Action, you know, Action's probably my age, which is like, you know, 40 or so.
So
I didn't feel so bad.
I feel you. There's a lot. Well, you know, with Daveed Diggs and Rafael Cassell, who are from the Bay Area, I think they're bringing back more awareness to the Bay. And they're bringing right now they're shooting Blindspotting out there in Oakland.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. So they're bringing more awareness and bringing it back to the roots, which I love because everyone doesn't realize how amazing the Bay Area is and how it has creatively shaped people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've had probably 4 or 5 guests from Oakland mainly, but you know, from the Bay Area in general, and such a history of activism and progressive issues. And you know, Bay Area has its problems like everywhere else, but yeah, just built into the DNA.
Yeah, I'm so proud to be from the Bay Area. I will always claim the Bay before I claim LA.
So, you know, the name of the podcast is the Chills at Will podcast. And so who are some of those writers, poets, particular texts, you know, novels, whatever form they come, mm-hmm. what were some of those lines, some of those books or some of those poems that really, you know, give you chills at will that you can repeat on almost like on command?
I have a handful of favorite poets that I listen mm-hmm. to. Two of which I talk about so much, incessantly almost, is Olivia Gatwood.
Okay.
And this other poet, Rudy Francisco. Mm. I've actually seen both of them perform, and it is so incredibly different to hear these performing poets be so involved in their work and to perform it in front of everyone rather than just sitting at home and reading it. You know, right. it's amazing. Right. And like for a particular sort of text, one of my favorite poems from Rudy Francisco, he has this poem that talks about, I think it's called Rifle. Mm. He talks about how they turned automatic weapons into musical instruments oh, yeah. and how you could change something so damning into something so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's sort of amazing. I mean, that's what artists do, right? Across whatever medium is they take something that maybe nothing to somebody else and turn into something really beautiful or meaningful or impactful. And that's always stuck with me. I always listen to that poem.
Yes.
I rather listen to him perform it just because you could feel it.
Sure.
And it just makes me want to work harder. I'm like, I can also make something beautiful out of something that's sort of not as beautiful to somebody else.
Sure. Well, you know, you talk about certain poems and poets, and you talk about listening to it. I got to think for you as an actor, as a performer, like mm-hmm. what is it about hearing? What is it about, you know, poetry as a spoken medium versus just reading it on the page? What is it that draws you to it?
I love both, but mm-hmm. I think what speaks to me about it is like, I feel like, especially if it's coming from the poet themselves, it feels mm-hmm. like I can connect with them. It feels like it feels more conversational than anything.
Right.
Yeah. And it feels so intimate. Mm-hmm. Like in my head, I could read Olivia Gatwood's book to myself. I could even read it aloud, but it won't feel the same way just mm-hmm. because I'm sure when she writes it, she has a voice in mind, a tone, a pitch, some, you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. it feels different coming from her.
Sure.
Because yeah. It obviously means something differently coming from her.
Course. Yeah, that makes sense. Did you struggle performing like when you like coming up? Was it something that was extremely nerve-wracking for you, or were you pretty much a natural and it was pretty smooth?
Oh, like with poetry or just performing in general?
Well, I guess both. Performing your own. I guess that is a different question. So, in performing your own poetry, is it something where maybe that's something that makes you more nervous than acting out someone else's scene? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it hands down, that's completely true. It made me hella nervous to.
There's one.
It made me hella nervous mm-hmm. to perform mm-hmm. my own stuff, just because, like it's amazing to have this opportunity and to have this book out, but it is incredibly personal and mm-hmm. intimate, and it feels mm-hmm. like I'm just peeling back the onion, and you're getting to closer to the core of me,
sure.
which isn't terrible, but. You know, there's things in my life that I want to keep private and for myself and to keep between like, you know, my relationships or to keep between me and my friends. But mm-hmm. I was very careful in selecting what poems go in, and performing my own stuff feels incredibly scary. It's mm-hmm. it's so vulnerable. And at this point I've had to perform through Zoom, which is a little easier.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is that little stint of fear is still there.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're going to talk about Millennial Dog Eater, which is the chat book. When did that come out? Did that come out during the pandemic or right before?
Yeah. During the pandemic. So yeah. I have been writing for a while, and I submitted during the pandemic. And mm-hmm. then like a month or two after, I think maybe in June, I got an email from Perennial Press, and they were like, we're going to make a chapbook. And then from then it's hit the ground running. And then it came out in October, mm-hmm. November. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you read differently now that like, now that you're published and now that you're like, you know, the craftswoman of it, like, do you read other people's work? Like not like you're like nitpicking, but do you read it more like a student of the game versus just reading for pleasure?
Yeah. It feels like the veil has been lifted because now I know how much work goes into it. I know how much time it takes. And mm-hmm. now with poetry books specifically, there's a reason why poems are put in a specific order. And I have fully analyzed that, and it feels okay. very different reading it now. Mm-hmm. And I did the same with mine. I switched up the order of the poem so many times because I want the readers to have a certain experience if they read it all the way through. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't something I ever thought of prior to getting published, you know. Sure. I was just like, oh, I'm just reading a book now. La la la.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how about, you know, it must be pretty cool to be called a writer because you are a published writer. What does that look like on a daily basis?
It feels weird. But on a daily basis, it just feels more like motivational, if anything,
okay.
to think about what the next project's going to be, or to think about like what the next manuscript is going to look like, what it's going to feel like. So it feels sort of like on to the next, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Are you one of those people where it's like, I'm going to write a poem a week or a poem a day, or is it like, yeah, I know, right? Or like, just take it as it comes whenever the inspiration hits kind of thing.
I feel like for a minute, I was like, I'm going to write every day for 10 minutes. And I never held true to that because it felt very forced mm-hmm. and it didn't feel as organic and as natural mm-hmm. as before. So I kind of just let it happen when it happens. I've been asked that a lot. Like, what's your creative process? Do you write often? I'm like, well, I write when I feel entirely engulfed in my emotions, or if I need to put displaced feelings somewhere, or when the inspiration sort of hits. And sometimes that looks like just typing it up on my little phone and then revisiting it later, or scribbling something down on a napkin or a post-it and saving it, and or just going for it right now, you know.
Like, is it cliche to be like, oh, you know, writing is like a cathartic process and it helps better understand the world? Is that cliche, or is there some truth in that?
I think, you know, for different writers, it means different things. I feel like it does feel cathartic. Mm-hmm. It does when it feels like it's just for me, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I share my poems with like my girlfriend or my best friend or something. Other times I just keep everything to myself just because I want it to be mine.
Sure.
But sometimes it does feel a little cliche when people say that.
Right.
Like, I'm going to change the world with this poem. And I'm like, you might, like, I'm not going to say you're not going to. You might mm-hmm. actually change the world with your poem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not Amanda Gorman, but that's incredible. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to put that in my head. I don't want to think that way just because I don't feel like I'll create organically.
Sure.
I'll start to create for other people, you know?
Well, I mean, speaking of that then, I mean, do you have a target audience, or is audience anybody who will read your poem or wants to read your poem?
I always felt weird when they look for target audience, because mm-hmm. they use target audience for books, for films, for mm-hmm. you know, everything. And I kind of feel like if it speaks to you, it speaks to you. If it mm-hmm. doesn't, it doesn't. It's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, anyone can pick up this chapbook, read it, and if you like it, you like it. If you hate it, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the work. Let's talk about Millennial Dog Eater on Perennial Press. Ooh, right?
Yes.
It comes with some cool postcards and kind of like stickers, and the cover is cool. Tell me about the cover. What is being depicted there?
Well, actually, what was interesting is the original cover they had like involved a dog, and it seemed a little chaotic and I didn't love it. And I felt like if this is the one opportunity I have to get something published, I want it to not be so chaotic. I just want it to be sort of simple and to pull focus to the name rather than the design. Sure. But the design is, you can tell it's like gold. For those of you who can't see this, it's gold print, sort of gold, with a black background. And it has an art deco, very like 1920s sort of vibe. It has a little fan and it's all patterned. But what I love about it is that it's all in like these rows and columns, and it's kind of like aesthetically pleasing to mm-hmm. look at, but you see at the very bottom, my name gets like kind of interrupts the space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I loved. Like okay. my name is right there, but it's sort of smeared in.
Sure.
So that idea of like rows and columns, like that whole theory is kind of gone.
Sure.
Cool. And I feel like that for anything, right? Mm-hmm. With this book, I don't think I'm going to revolutionize the world or the state of our country at this moment, but I think it's important for people to understand, like, there are rows and columns, there's rules in place, but these might be old practices that you can break through and make a difference. And so that's what I really loved about the design.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's safe to say, right, you like to refer to yourself as eclectic.
Yeah, just because I can't really pin down one thing for myself.
Yeah, I like that. I'm in agreement with you there. I take pride in being eclectic. The title, and well, I guess backing up a little bit, for those of us who are amateurs, what exactly is a chapbook?
A chapbook is what I've defined it as, like a baby book. It is a saddle stitch book. It is, I don't believe it's more than about 50 pages.
Okay.
I guess the binding's kind of, I don't know, not as thick or as durable as a novel, but it's sort of a cross between a book and a pamphlet.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's pretty popular among poets. Most poets have chapbooks.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the, like the structure of how you structure and format the poems, like the order of the poems.
Yes.
And I believe Millennial Dog Eater is the last one.
So yeah.
That's very interesting. And why, where did the title come from? The title for the whole collection for the chapbook?
Well, I'll tell you that the title came before the poem. So Millennial Dog Eater, the poem, was one of the last poems to make it in before we got published or before we went to printing. I had that name for a really long time because we're living in a really difficult time in this country. It's a fantastically furious time to be alive in America right now. And I am a queer first generation person of color and a woman in America. And I've been given labels, one of which is millennial and another is dog eater, which is a slur. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to sort of reclaim it and be a little ballsy. I'm going to be hella ballsy and go with millennial dog eater. And this is sort of like an FU to the America a little bit, or, you know, to labels, I guess.
Yeah.
Dog eater specifically is a slur, unfortunately. And it is also sort of inspired from the book Dog Eaters by Jessica Hagedorn.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Great book I read in college. Fantastic.
I've heard of it, but I've not read it. I mean, is the subject matter anywhere similar to yours or?
Yeah, it's about Filipino Americans.
Okay.
Who moved to San Francisco. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, indulge in the book if you have the opportunity. Yeah. It's a great read, but it was one of the first books I read that I was like, wow, there's someone who came up from the same upbringing as me and has, you know, will look like me if they ever decide to make a movie from it, you know?
Right. Obviously, you know, you traffic in words and placement and all that is so important. I mean, you talk about like reclaiming the slur and all that. Would you say that queer works in the same way? Because, you know, obviously that's one that's been used as an epithet for a long time. Is that part of like reclaiming that? You know, you choose to use that, I believe, in your biography, you know, as well. So what does the word mean for you?
This is interesting. I've gotten into arguments with other people from the LGBT community about this. It's a personal thing for me. I identify myself as queer just because I am bisexual and I feel like queer was sort of all encompassing. It's just, I felt like I got a lot less questions when people would ask about my sexuality if I said bisexual. I mean, I'm sorry, if I said queer. I know the history behind the word queer is not great.
Right.
It's also a derogatory term. It also meant like you were broke. So it's interesting now. I think I've read a book about it recently, a graphic novel about the LGBT history. Mm-hmm. And the word queer has been like, that's a bad word. You shouldn't say it. But I think for me personally, I feel like it's the best word to describe me.
Mm-hmm.
Like bisexual is like the easiest way to, I guess, digest it. But queer is sort of all encompassing for me. And, you know, I want to do what's right by me, I guess, at this point.
Yeah. And why the heck not, right?
Yeah.
Appreciate that. Fiction versus nonfiction. You talked about how it's, you know, it is your writing of yourself. It is difficult to put it on the page at times. But I guess I'm wondering, like, are there some parts that are, I'm not saying you'd have to break it down and be like, well, 76% is fictional, and 76%, you know, but do you feel like maybe, I guess what I'm getting at is when you do write fictionally, if that's a word, do you feel like that's freeing in some ways too, that you can put a little distance between yourself and what you're writing?
Yeah, there are, maybe a handful of poems, I think two or three in this Millennial Dog Eater that I've taken steps back in because they have been like a little too close.
Okay.
So the way that I had structured it has been a little different. The way that I had formatted in like in terms of how it looks has been a little bit different. And I just tried to create as much space because it felt a little too close and a little too much at one moment.
I mean, I appreciate, again, you said, you talking about how there was a restructuring, and I know that writers are going to take a chance on, or going to take the opportunity to put things in particular orders, but it makes a lot of sense in your chapbook. You begin with the preamble, you end with the title, you know, poem. The preamble is kind of like a reimagining of the forefathers.
Right? Yeah.
And then you have four parts, correct me if I'm wrong, you have four parts of Letters to a Former Lover, which is America. And they're not right next to each other. They're skip, you know, two or three poems or whatever between. And there definitely is a really strong buildup. And so, you know, I feel like you really successfully did it with the structuring there.
Thank you. That weirdly took so much time. As soon as I was done, I put them in different orders. I read them all the way through. I'm like, this doesn't feel right. So I had to go back.
Yeah.
Like at one point I had all, the poems that were about romance all sort of bundled together. And then I had all of my angstier sort of poems bundled all together, and it just didn't feel right. It just felt like we were jumping from one mood.
Yes.
To abruptly to the next, where I just wanted it to sort of flow together. I had to break it up a little bit.
You definitely pulled it off. I mean, you're a movie person, of course, you know that a lot of times you might just remember the beginning and the end. And so obviously you got to have that powerful beginning, that powerful ending. So the preamble starts with, like, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. is next to Lady Liberty. America, you describe as like having no makeup on, going to sleep at two, alive and brawny and beautiful. And, you know, the last two lines are really powerful. I don't know if you could maybe read those last two lines.
Yeah. One day Lady Liberty will be standing next to an MLK statue. One day America whispered into my ear that she doesn't hold my existence as a queer woman of color as treason, but in public she must.
The sentence, one day America whispered in my ear, a long one, you know, it's a good, strong flowing sentence. And then the last one is just very abrupt, and it definitely leaves you like thinking. What's the idea there behind, I guess, surface level, that America as a whole has to hold on to these antiquated homophobic ways, but it's changing? Or what were you going for with that?
I think America is divided completely. And I don't think that's surprising to anybody.
Sure.
If you turn on the news, anyone will tell you we're vastly divided and in almost all issues at this point. And so it feels like what I was going for is, I envision America as a girl who looks and feels like someone you know, like you grew up with, you've known your entire life, but is always sort of flip-flop between their opinions, and is someone who's sort of flaky and, you know, works two jobs, like works really hard, but like has to throw on all this makeup to present herself a certain way. And that's kind of how I envision America now, is things are not really set in stone. Everyone is incredibly divided.
You know, one of the other poems is called 12, and it's that, you know, that formative age right before teenage years. And it's,
You
know, it talks a lot about body image and the way is it safe to say the way that we tear women down? Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, when I was 12, it was really scary. Like if I was 12 now, I think it'd be very different. Like everyone now is so inclusive, and everyone loves everyone's bodies and celebrates each other. You know, when I was 12, you were weird when you weren't like everybody else. Like, you, if you weren't white and blonde with blue eyes and pretty and funny and all these other things that you're supposed to be at 12 or like 13, then you weren't, you were just like an outlier. You were sort of unnecessary. So it was kind of weird being 12 at that age, which was like 2002, like the early 2000s.
And again, like I was talking about, you have that, the gradual buildup, the progression. You know, there's something about reading the same, kind of the same subject matter, but moving it forward a bit. I'm talking about the Letters to a Former Lover. The first one assigned an American. The second assigned a New American. The third assigned a Queer American. And the fourth assigned a BIPOC American, you know, B-I-P-O-C. Who were you picturing as writing those? Who was the American? Who was a New American? You know what I mean? Why
That was, I believe, I was trying to write these letters in different facets of myself, because I am technically an American, but I also come from a family of immigrants. So I was trying to write from that perspective, because I understand that perspective from my parents. And then I was writing as a queer American, because I am queer, and writing as a person of color, you know. The way that, if you, I mean, I wanted to break down how I'm read to people, like, because technically I'm American, I'm queer, I'm a person of color, I'm a woman, and I'm all these things. But how does that, if I break those things down separately, what does that look like? What does that feel like? And that's kind of what I wanted to go for.
So four parts of the same whole, four parts of the same person.
Yes.
Part two is, that's the one signed by a New American. And that's really short, but it's really strong. It's, I think, half English, half Tagalog. And it's the powerful play on words. I don't know if you might be able to read that one, you know, being that it's so short.
Yeah, for sure. I can't say that I can read the Tagalog part, but I will tell you that what I'm reading in English is exactly what's written in Tagalog.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah. So, Letters to a Former Lover, Part Two. Dear America, tell me why immigrants are the proudest Americans, but America will never be proud of immigrants. Sincerely, a New American.
Really cool play on words there.
Yeah. And thank you. Thank you. My dad actually really loved that one. And he speaks and reads Tagalog. And he was like, you rewrote it again, but in Tagalog. And I'm like, yeah, I was like, that makes sense. Like, in, for him, it was like clicking. And he's not a man that reads books or watches movies or indulges in things like that. So it was cool for, you know, to connect to my dad on that level.
Really cool. Was it straight Google Translate, or was it like, you knew how to, like, the translation, or you knew how to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I know how to translate. I can't write Tagalog, because if you look at it, like, it, Tagalog is hard.
Yeah.
It's like a mishmash of different words, and the enunciations are very different. So I did have to consult my mom. It was like easy. 2 seconds, she like texted it over. I'm like, that's what you need to put. Nice. I'm like, oh, okay, cool.
Nice. There's a poem called Japanese Grandma, and I'm such a huge fan of poems or literature that ends with a question. And
really, that's interesting.
Oh man, the question is, Japanese grandma, have you another name? And just the idea of the labels we put on people, but also just like not knowing some, right? I don't assume that you knew your grandma.
Well, no,
you didn't, right? But just kind of like you heard like in bits and pieces. And there's just something about that, you know. You look at a picture of your grandma and you're like, maybe when she was younger, you're like, oh my god, she was a person.
Exactly.
Right. And for you to just say, you know, have you another name? That's just awesome.
Thank you. That poem was like a little touchy, because it's my dad's mother. My dad's half Filipino, half Japanese. He didn't really fully know his mom. She left him at a very young age. And it, so I know bits and pieces of her, and I have seen only one picture of her. And apparently, of everyone in my family, I look the most like her.
Really?
Yeah. And I act like her a little bit, they say, but it's so weird because I don't know her. And I've always called her my Japanese grandmother or my Japanese grandma. And I'm like, I wish I knew what her name was, like her, what, I don't know, what do her friends call her? Like, I don't know anything.
Yeah. Then, you know, like you said, you don't put them all together, but you have a few that, you know, you could maybe call poems of love or romance, her, how to love her less. I want to hold your hand in public, which is, I mean, they're all beautiful, but it's also very wrenching, you know.
Yeah.
Were those ones hard to write? Were those ones easier writing love and romance? How did that go?
So I started, I don't really, I'm not ever a poet that indulges in like romantic poems at all, but I fell for someone very deeply, like almost a year and a half, almost 2 years ago. And I, for some reason, just felt like I want to write. And then I did. And it formed into poems about this girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, How to Love Her Less is a little heavier, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know if I would say that was like a romantic poem. Yeah,
right.
But like her, I Want to Hold Your Hand in Public, The Girl at the Piano, and there's another one. But they're all about the same person. And it's just, it came at an interesting time because I wrote one poem at the very beginning of our relationship, one like a little more months down the road, and like one like a little bit more after that. So mm-hmm. it came into this thing of like all these poems about the same person evolving and how that relationship changes.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in the correct order that I would put them in.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of like, if I had to put them all together.
Chronological. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it is new for me, I will tell you that, just because I don't write poems about love. Like, I think it's so weird. I think it's hella weird.
Yeah. That's three on the hell out. I appreciate it. Let's keep them coming.
I know. I was being really mindful of that.
No, obviously, like you said, How to Love Her Less. Yeah, it has the word love in it, but it's not. I mean, it's heavy. Love, romance wouldn't necessarily be the best label. But yeah, I mean, I don't think I've ever tried it, because I've read some cringy romantic love, and it's just like, I got to figure it's really hard to do. And yours didn't come off as cheesy or cringy or any of that.
Well, thank you.
Especially like, I Want to Hold Your Hand in Public is, you can tell from the title, like, why do we have to hide? Why does it have to be a weird thing for other people or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder like how much of it is, especially, you know, coming from the Bay Area and having that kind of activist history. The idea of kind of like, I don't know, respectability politics. Do you know what I mean by that?
A little bit.
The idea of like, you know, for queer and gay, you know, LGBT, for the community to be accepted, we need to be like on our best behavior. And
yeah.
We need people to see that we're just like everyone else, you know, which is reductive, right?
A little bit.
Right. Versus the idea of kind of like, you know, fight the system. I wonder how much you feel like there was a balance in not just in that poem, but in all the things you've written about, I want to show who I am in all my different facets, you know, and make myself be seen by you, but also the system sucks, like down with it. I don't know. I don't know if that's too hard of a question.
No. It's not hard at all. I love that question. I mean, especially now, with all these hate crimes that have been happening. Mm. I'm not gonna lie, these hate crimes have been happening. It's just being publicized now more frequently in the media. I think in my own small way, and this, like some of these poems that are very much like Boot on My Neck, or you know, poem, or Brown Girl, like those poems are meant to be sort of like a gentle little middle finger to everyone who says like, this is like, you're not where you need to be. And I think that, in its small way, is sort of my version of revolting.
Yeah, I mean, politics or whatever you want to call it, you get into with gentrification.
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Right. One of the poems, you have a great line about something about kind of, you know, Highland Park, as we talked about before we started recording, is kind of like the stereotypical face of gentrification. You know, if you live in LA or SoCal, you know all about it. You have a line about sitting up tall in, you know, like this white woman, this gentrifier, sitting up tall in chairs made by brown hands. You have another poem about San Francisco, which, you know, maybe you know better being from the Bay. What prompted you to write about gentrification? Like, have you been personally affected by it, or, you know, how have you kind of seen it play out over these years?
I mean, I've been affected by it in the sense that I've been just a bystander watching things happen.
Mm-hmm.
San Francisco is a huge part of, I believe, my identity and my adult formative years. I spent a handful of time there because of college, and I was born there, and I went out to San Francisco every weekend. So I've seen it take on different looks in the past 30 years of my life. And it has been interesting and scary. And it is a form of colonization, just with a different name. And I have, obviously, I don't have a business. I don't have family that has a business that has been pushed out by big corporations, but I could feel it as a person who was still part of that community, how that is in like, how it has affected small families or small businesses, how it's affected families, how it affects the community that is native to that city. And it's so interesting. And, you know, moving from San Francisco to LA, I mean, it's a jump and it's huge, but what I thought was interesting, like gentrification is everywhere. I don't have to be in a specific place for it to be new, you know? So Highland Park is a perfect example of that in Los Angeles, and how they want to like rebrand like very, you know, like cultural traditions and make it their own and take it. And that never sat well with me ever.
You mentioned the boot on my neck, unfortunately, was inspired by George Floyd. That's a strong one. I mean, that's a not an easy read, but a really good read. Brown Girl, you know, based on the famous Brown Bear. What made you, the idea of the muse, like I'm a big fan of that also, like finding some sort of muse, whether it's some other form of creative, you know, expression and using that. What made you decide to base it on Brown Bear?
You know what? It was weird. I think because we were talking about, I don't know, it started off with me and my friends talking about the Bernstein Bears. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And then and then I was like, yeah, I forgot about all those books. And we were like, oh, Brown Bear. You remember that book? I was like, yeah. Like, what a catchy little, like, rhythmic poem book that we used to read as kids. And I'm like, yeah. And I made a joke. I was like, you know, if we ever saw that book again, like now, it'd be Brown Boy, or Brown Girl. Kind of like it stuck with me.
Libel moment.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like a weird joke, but it sounds really like it could be very poignant. So I ran with it, and I love hip hop and rap. And I thought, like, I tried really hard not to put any poems that rhymed in here, but I'm like, this was my one thing to be like, I can afford to do this.
Nice. Small Distractions, you said, is a crowd favorite. And
when I say crowd favorite, I mean like me and my friend and like my girlfriend really like it.
And me and the people I'm going to pass it on to. No, it's a really good one. It's very, very topical, you know, with technology and just the way our society is. And like, you know, that could be an area, like the area of like, you know, get off your screen, blah, blah, blah. Like that's kind of been done, but you did it in a very creative way, a very original way. It doesn't sound like it's something like, oh, geez, one of these again.
Thank you.
I thought maybe you could read Small Distraction.
Yeah, I would love to. Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
Small Distractions. A splendid disposition to be alive and breathing. It's despicable to think otherwise, that the job with health benefits and the pristine house in an affluent neighborhood and the mediocre family with beaming faces are the only things that carry weight. But it doesn't deviate from death. It doesn't delay the deadline, doesn't rebel against science. We fill ourselves with small distractions and let the nuances breathe a little bit more life into us. We take our place in the world fantastically obsessing to be important, to be remembered as something more than the defect of a condom. As if retweets and likes will compose symphonies at our funerals. As if our digital footprints won't tread on our ashes. Small distractions will always exist. The unremarkable urges between teenagers, the quiet rumblings of Instagram followers, the seething quakes of babies being born. It's the small distractions that construct the idea of life. It becomes about the next paycheck, the next party, the next heartbreak, the next promotion, the next small distraction that we could fawn over, that we can cry over, that we can obsess over, and then what? We continue to fracture ourselves into factions, meticulously piece each other back together in the name of love. Built atop of defining moments that disguises itself as life, there are just these small distractions.
I literally can't snap, but I would if I could. Like I don't have the ability. I've had 100 people try to teach me. I just can't do it.
What?
Yeah, I know.
No way.
Terrible. When I got to the bottom of, it happened to be on page 13, I thought that was the end of the poem. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, was that even something that you designed, or was that just totally out of your hands?
Was out of my hands.
Okay. Yeah. Some great lines. The mediocre family with beaming faces. I love the alliteration of doesn't deviate death, doesn't delay deadline. The sound, you know, definitely comes through there.
Yes.
Right.
I love wordplay, and you'll notice, I think, that I try to go in rhythms or follow a certain rhythm. Like, I'll go in like rule of threes pretty much. I'll repeat the same thing, but I'll change a little bit every time. And I totally took advantage of that in this poem where I did it like five times. But well, I really wanted to play with words in that sense.
And yeah, I mean, it's cool to hear you read it, like you talked about earlier, just like you were the one who wrote it, you know where the certain breaks should be, et cetera. And again, like, you know, some of the subject matter we've heard about before, but you talk about how it's, these are not new things. And you talk about the universality of things like the unremarkable urges between teenagers. I love the phrase, the seething quakes of babies being born, because that's for dang sure. right? Asking those questions, making us think, and then what? Like, yeah, and then what? You know, we're forced to think about that. We continue to fracture ourselves into factions. Fracture and factions is so cool. And then the idea of meticulously piecing ourselves together. Built atop of defining moments that disguises itself at life. There are just these small distractions. I love the idea of defining moments disguising themselves as life. And, you know, it all comes back to the small distractions. Again, home plate, right? The poem is called Small Distractions. And the last line of the poem is Small Distractions. Heck of an accomplishment. You wrote in what, 10 minutes or?
That poem. That actually took me an hour. Like it originally stopped after my favorite line, which was to be remembered as something more than a defect of a condom.
Right.
That was always my favorite line. I wanted to get t-shirts of that, but stopped.
It's not
there.
Too late, right? You can still do that.
Yeah, maybe. I was talking to my publishers about it, but I originally stopped there and I just felt like there was still more that I wanted to say. I'm like, but there's still more, like, I want them to know what exactly I meant. And then I had to keep going and it just evolved.
Yeah. I feel like that would be a poem that I could teach at the high school level, you know, and then obviously they would get something different than a 50-year-old would, a 50-year-old with more life experience. You know, it's very specific in many ways, but it's also universal. So really well done.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe one more. Which one would you like to read?
You know what? How about I read The Casting Director Says?
Yeah, tell me the page number if you wouldn't mind.
36.
All right.
Weirdly enough, we are shooting a film, like a short promotional video for this poem specifically.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm about to go record the audio. And then we're just going to go and film it in a couple weeks. So
cool.
I figured we should get a little practice in right now.
Yeah, I like it.
All right. This is The Casting Director Says. The casting director says that they're celebrating diverse actors. And when the casting director says diverse, they mean Black women being sassy diverse, Asian girls being nerdy diverse, Latin girls acting spicy diverse, Indian man driving a taxi diverse, Black man selling drugs diverse, Mexicans can't speak English diverse, Indigenous people being ignored diverse. The casting director says we need to empower different stories. And by different stories, they mean not white. Because less white means more buzz, more shock value, more money. More than half of the industry was built on the same narrative as the white experience in America. But on this other side of the brown bag tests, hot yoga classes, and native headpieces worn at Coachella, there is us. The first generation babies of split tongue and open air markets. Your temporary multimedia band-aids coming in an assortment of melanin, blessing your screens with slanted eyes, chancletas, box braids, Santa Ninos, and cocoa butter. We already know the disparity of diverse narratives. We are the disparity of diverse narratives. When the casting director says they need diverse actors, we come running with chopsticks in hands, hot combs in our hair, and tamales in our mouths. But diversity is not putting on an accent for punchlines or fashioning yourself in stereotypes. Diversity is existing as a person of color and carrying your traditions and your ancestors' narratives in your back pocket. So when the casting director says they're celebrating diverse actors, we ask when. Thank you.
Yeah, that the line about carrying your traditions and ancestors' narratives in your back pocket, that's very impressive. I'm glad you read that one for many reasons. One was that you use it as a motif like three or four times throughout the collection, is the idea of the split tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just the idea of like, of even being able to speak different languages at home and that kind of thing? I mean, I've heard split tongue being used for different things. What did you kind of mean when you wrote that?
I mean it in both senses, where someone who is bilingual and someone who, and I don't know if like, I think you'd be aware of this too. It's like, you speak very differently when you're at home with your family than you do when you're outside.
Sure.
Like at home, my parents only speak Tagalog to us and, or they'll speak Taglish. So half Tagalog, half English, but out in public, they only speak English and they drop their accents. So it's like this idea of, you know, duality and how does that work together. And, you know, being like the first generation kid, like being American, but also being, you know, a Filipino American is a weird sort of, I guess, identity to navigate because you're kind of the through line.
You know, the idea of, I feel like, you know, probably you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, this idea like, hey, we're looking for diversity. Oh, cool. I'm getting a position. But like you talk about, are you continuing the stereotypes? Are you, you know, you're just being thrown, you know, thrown a little bit of scraps. Like, yeah, play this little part just to get our money up. And like you talk about the shock value is buzz, is shock value. It's not telling these authentic stories.
They're like, wow, look at this all Asian cast, or look at like this film about Black people. Like that is so revolutionary. I'm like, well, they've been Black forever. We've been Asian forever. Why is this a surprise for everybody? You know,
have you had experience? Like, I mean, have you like tried out for a lot of parts and that kind of thing?
Yes. Oh yeah. This poem was created because this has happened too many times. And I have a lot of friends who are also actors and people of color, and they have more or less the same experience. When they get into the room, they're asked to put on an accent that's not really theirs, or they're asked to play into a stereotype. And it's interesting because Hollywood is trying very hard to open more doors for people of color and to celebrate diverse actors and diverse narratives. And that's amazing. And that's wonderful. But I think what they need to do is just open the doors for like people of color who are directors and writers and give them the space to tell their story rather than having other people try to tell our story. Because I mean, in truth, it gets sort of lost in the mix, right? You can only talk about someone else's experience as far as the extent of your knowledge.
Right.
And I think that's what's happening quite a bit. Like, it's amazing. Hollywood is really making efforts, but it just may be the wrong sort of move. Like their intentions, great place, but you know.
Yeah. Like the idea of like being behind the camera more than in front of the camera. So you can make the decisions and hopefully the ones, you know, funding in as well. Right. So tell those stories. Yeah.
I love being in front and behind. I love being very hands-on with that whole process because storytelling is amazing in its facet, right? Like it's so beautiful. But, you know, if you have the opportunity to take control of your narrative, why wouldn't you, you know? Right.
Thank you so much for reading that. For reading
of course.
I appreciate that. What's next? What are you working on besides, you know, besides trying out there in Hollywood, trying to get your name out there?
Right now, I'm actually working on a web series and in terms of like, it's in pre-production. So hopefully when COVID and all of our things are lifted and we all get the vaccine, hopefully we could start shooting that fairly soon. I'm also working on my next manuscript. So I'm pretty excited.
When you're working on your next manuscript, I mean, is it just like, hey, I've got a few poems already and like, I'm thinking about putting them together, or you like, or did like the title and the project come first and then the poetry, the work came next?
Oh no, the poetry came first.
Yeah, I would think so.
Because I had a handful, like maybe about 7 poems that didn't make it into Millennial Dog Eater. And some of them were just because I was writing them as we were printing it. So it's like, it's a little too late. But I also saw that there's an opportunity for a different sort of through line. I mean, Millennial Dog Eater is very like American centric, which is great. But I think this next manuscript that I'm working on is a little different, and it's going to feel a little bit closer to Small Distractions.
Okay.
Because Small Distractions and Boot on My Neck were the last poems to get in, and Millennial Dog Eater.
Well, it seems like that's one of the cool things about the chapbook, and I guess maybe publishing more these days, is that it's very current, you know, and like, I mean, that poem will read great in 20 years also, but it just seems like, I guess the idea that you're able to publish more often and, you know, get that work out there. You know, we don't have to wait 20 hours or 20 days, 20 weeks to get something published. Is that it?
Right.
Has that freshness to it for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So hopefully we'll see some stuff happen.
So, so thankful for you to come on. It's so cool to see somebody who's such a jack of all trades, so eclectic, you know, in your taste, you're an actor, you're content creator, poet, There's, you know, there's no one label that, that kind of like marks you, and that's really cool. Thanks so much for Thanks so much for sharing the process behind writing it as well. And I know some of it's personal, so really appreciate it. And I don't know, NoCal for life. Thank you so much. I wish you great luck in the rest of your continued great luck with your work.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure to have you on. Thank you for listening to episode 51 of the Chills at Will podcast with Marina Benzon. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find the pod on Spotify and on Amazon Music and Stitcher, which is new. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will podcast is Wind Down, instrumental version. And the other song played on this episode was Hoops, instrumental by Matt Whitehour. Both great songs are used through archesaudio.com. For now, thanks again for listening. And I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts like Millennial Dog Eater by writers with mad skills like Marina Benzon, whose work gives you chills at will.